Welcome to Antioch. We are a multi-generational, justice-minded church in beautiful Bend, Oregon, seeking and celebrating the reconciliation of all things. May the Word of God turn your heart toward Christ and the world He loves.
As we move from gathering to listening, our scripture reading today is from the book of John, chapter 5, verses 2 through 18. Now there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I am trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me." Then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath, and so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, "It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" And so they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well. So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. In his defense, Jesus said to them, "My Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working." And for this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Well, this morning we have a guest preacher with us, excuse me, and his name is Tony Jones, and it is his first time here at Antioch, but in his life, Tony has been many things, a PhD, a theologian, a pastor, he's an outdoorsman, he's a hunter, he's a podcaster, though anybody can do that, really, he's an author as well, and he was my doctoral cohort professor at Fuller, but his most recent book is The God of Wild Places, Rediscovering the Divine in the Untamed Outdoors. And so we wanted to invite Tony to kick us off for the season of creation. This book is a little bit of his memoir, life story. He will tell you a little bit more about that, but let's give Tony a warm Antioch welcome.
Thanks, buddy. Hey, everybody. Good morning. Great to be here. I was going to tell you all about how Sean is as a student, but there's like these FERPA federal guidelines. So I'm not allowed to talk about publicly about students. But Sean was a great student. My wife told me on the drive over here, he's one of my favorites of all your students. So that was... if he makes a good impression on Courtney, that's great. My wife Courtney's here. We're in town for a wedding. I performed my niece's wedding last night outdoors in Bend, and we thought it was going to be, you know, August in Bend, and it turned out to be November in Bend while we were here. But it was great, beautiful night, and preaching twice this morning gave me the opportunity not to go to the after party with my kids who are all in their 20s and were deeply disappointed that my night ended at 10 p.m. But I was fine with that. And they were all still in bed. We rented a house in Tetherow and they were sound asleep. But I'm sure they are watching the live stream. No. No, they're definitely not. But we love it here in Bend. My brother has lived in Bend since 2004. So I think he's now one who complains whenever he sees a California license plate. And I'm like, well, you also immigrated to Bend. Like, no, it's different. He feels like a native now. But I get back here like probably once a year, and have loved being able to connect with Sean since he's moved here. So it's great to be here this morning at Antioch. And I want to give a spoiler alert, because I'm going to tell about some hard parts of my life. And this is like the worst thing you can do in storytelling, is like tell how it ends. But it all ends well. There's a photo here, because my kids didn't make it to church this morning. That's me and my kids. I got two in their 20s, and then the middle one there, he's now a freshman or a sophomore at TCU. He's probably on his way to the airport here any minute to fly back and go back to college. But everything ended up well, okay? Everything ended up well. But now I'm going to backtrack and tell you some stuff that didn't go so well. The next picture is my ordination day, which was September 7th, 1997. And I'm standing there with my three favorite high school teachers, each of whom came that day to watch me be ordained into the ministry. And it was the end of a long journey for me that started when I was in probably, I think, seventh grade was the first time that I articulated a call to ministry. I was picked to give the offering prayer on Youth Sunday at our church. And I was in, you know, seventh grade, and so my mom gave me a little recipe card out of her recipe card box and a pen, and then the youth pastor picked me up in his van. I remember this very vividly, because you may not know this, but youth ministry doesn't pay great, and I was a youth minister for many, many years, and he picked me up in this van that only had the front two seats, and all the other seats had been taken out of the van, and it was just full of PVC pipe because he installed underground sprinklers on the side to be able to like make a living as a youth pastor. And he took me to McDonald's, and we had breakfast, and he helped me kind of write my offertory prayer. And then he, you know, I think he was just making conversation, because I was like a super awkward seventh grade boy. And he's like, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? You know, just making conversation. And I said, oh, I want to be a youth minister. And I look back on that now, and I think it's because my dad used to come home from work. My dad was a business guy, and he would come home from work in a bad mood every day. And he wore a suit with a tie to work every single day. And he came home, and he was just, I don't know, he just seemed to me like he was always upset about something at work. And then we'd have dinner, and then he would go into his office and close the door and keep working. And then I looked at Paul, my youth pastor, and this dude, like, he wore shorts every day. I never, ever saw him in a tie. He got paid to take us on ski trips to Colorado. He like got paid to go whitewater rafting. I'm like, what? Why in the world would anybody do what my dad does when this is like an actual thing you can do? You can be a youth pastor? So that was like, that set the trajectory of my life. And then I just was on that path all the way through high school, all the way through college. I went straight to seminary. I went to Fuller, where Sean got his doctorate. And that's where I got my master's. And it was the path I was on until, and then I did some work on a Native American reservation in South Dakota, and then ended up on that day, my ordination day in 1997. And everything was just as I thought it was going to be. Everything was going perfectly to plan. That same year I got married, bought a house, got a yellow lab, like lived in the suburbs, had a job at a church as a youth pastor. It was like, this was it. It was the culmination. And I thought everything was going to, of course, continue to go smoothly after that. One evening, I was with the youth committee. And the youth committee at a church, this is a big kind of mainline-y type church in Minnesota where I was the youth pastor. And the youth committee was parents, just like well-meaning parents, who would come once a month and help me like plan the confirmation banquet, or how are we going to do fundraising for the mission trip? You know, these were just parents of kids in the youth group who were helping me out. And for whatever reason, one night, I have this vivid memory of this night, I came completely unglued at these well-meaning parents. I lost it. I became so angry, and I can't even remember what the issue was. I mean, I'm still in touch with some of the people who were in the room that night. They can't either. But two of the parents of two different kids, this guy named Doug and a mom named Linda, they were like the chair and the vice chair of the committee, and they ended the meeting, and I remember them walking me to my car and trying to calm me down. And Doug said, "Why don't we go have breakfast?" I was 30, I was 29, maybe 30. He said, "Let's go have breakfast this week." And we did. And he said, "I think you have a lot of anger." And he said, "I have a lot of anger." He was in recovery from alcohol and drug use. He had been for many, many years. And he said he'd gone through an anger management course. And he encouraged me to do that as well, which I did do. I went through the same anger management course that he did. And he said, "And have you ever been hunting?" No, I'd never been hunting. My dad didn't hunt. My grandfathers didn't hunt. It was not a thing we did. He said, "Why don't you come duck hunting with me?" He's like, "Yeah, sure." And I took him up on that offer, and I thought maybe, I don't know, we're going to, you know, go to some pond and shoot a couple ducks or whatever. Well, I got in his van, and we drove 6 hours to Paudette, Minnesota. And then we got in a boat, and we went 4 more hours into Lake of the Woods. And then we found a little cabin that he had way up in the Canadian part of Lake of the Woods. And then we got in another boat, and we went for 4 more hours to get to the one little wild rice bed where he liked to duck hunt. And I was, at age 30, the farthest away I had ever been from civilization, the deepest I had ever been in the wilderness. I really had no idea what I was getting into. And there were some crazy, Doug is this kind of larger than life figure who ended up mentoring me in the outdoors, and particularly in duck hunting and in pheasant hunting. And just to give you a sense of him, we would do this deal where we would go out early in the morning, and we'd, like when it was still super dark, you know, we'd go in 4 in the morning and we'd motor in his duck boat until we got to the wild rice bed where he wanted to duck hunt. And we'd throw out some decoys by the light of, this was like pre-LED and rechargeable batteries. We had a car battery in the bottom of the boat, and I was holding this 1,000,000 candle watt spotlight, and I would shine it, and he'd throw some decoys out and whatever. And then we'd sit down in the back in the boat with his dogs, and he would rev the motor and run the boat up onto a bog, and we'd sit there and wait for the sun to come up, shoot some ducks, whatever, and then it was over. I remember this one time, we couldn't get the boat off of the bog after we were done duck hunting. And there's these long push poles you have in these duck boats. And so I'm like, you're doing this thing where you're trying to like jiggle the boat off the bog, but it was just jammed up on this bog. Doug is like 6'4", 280. Okay? Enormous, enormous human being. You just have to have that in mind when I tell you this part. Then I hear this splashing in the water, and I turn around, and Doug is completely naked outside the boat, in the bog, like up to his waist in goo in the bog, pushing the boat off the bog back into the lake, into the open water. And then when he's done, when he gets it in, he rolls into the boat. And he's like flopping around. There's dogs and decoys and dead ducks and a car battery. It's just like complete madness, okay? Complete madness. But on the way home after one late night hunt, bad weather set in, which meant we had a great duck hunt, but we had a rough, rough ride back. And we got lost. I didn't even know it at the time. I just knew that it was getting darker and colder, and we weren't getting back to the cabin. And this was like Doug did not have a GPS. There were no maps, and he just had this in his mind. And Lake of the Woods is an enormous lake, one of the biggest lakes in North America, and it has 15,000 islands, okay? So every shoreline looks the same, and I figured he knew where he was until in the middle of this storm, fog had settled in, big waves coming over the side of the boat, and he pulls into this little bay, and he says to me, "I'm lost. I don't know where we are, and if we don't get back to the cabin soon, we're going to run out of gas. So pretty soon, I'm just going to pull up onto some shoreline, and we're going to spend the night huddled up under a tree with the dogs and wait for the sun to come up and hope we can find our way back." This is a moment for me, okay? We get back in the boat and we're driving and I'm sitting on the floor of the boat and this weather is, and the dogs, cold, wet dogs shivering on either side of me. I remember how cold I was and I remember making a decision not to be scared. I remember making a decision that I couldn't get us out of this predicament, only Doug could. And that no matter how deep we were in the woods, that everything was going to be okay. And here's the thing for me, looking back, I don't think I really understood it at the time. But what I learned that day was that when I was out in the wild places, when I could make that turn to give up control, I could release all sorts of anger that I had. I was a very angry young man, and I was in a very toxic marriage at the time that was killing me. But I wasn't dealing with that in healthy ways. It was coming out sideways, like screaming at people, parents on a youth committee, you know? But this was a pivotal moment for me being out in this wild place. And it allowed me to make some kind of a turn and realize I had things to learn outside of the very orderly church world in which I had felt so comfortable, where everything lined up so perfectly for me, where I was able to do things like speak with a microphone on in front of a bunch of people, you know, and write books and lead youth group and balance budgets and the things I was good at externally that everybody thought everything was all okay with me. I knew and was hiding from myself in a lot of ways how broken things were inside of me. And one of the first times I really felt the peace, it's funny, ironically, the peace that I would preach to my congregation that I didn't actually experience or feel, I felt in that duck boat with Doug. So what I've tried to do in this book and more recently in my life is to try to find places where God is moving in the wilderness, where I can find God outside. A lot of times in the church, we, of course, use the Bible, and I'm going to use the Bible a little bit this morning, and that's what theologians refer to as revealed theology, that we understand things about God because of the way God has revealed God's self in things like maybe God speaks to you in your life, or maybe a miracle happens, or we read it in a text that God delivered, or we see the words of Jesus, God's, you know, God on earth. This is the primary way that most of us, most of the time in the church, come to God and try to understand God and see what God's up to, what we can learn. But there's also this other version of theology that's got a history in the church, but we don't hear about it quite as often. And it's called natural theology. And what natural theology posits is that if God is the creator of all this, then there must be fingerprints of God in the creation. We can learn things about God in the creation without the revelation. Not that it's, these things aren't opposed, right? They're not mutually exclusive. It's just that there are ways to learn things about the Creator from the creation. And we can think of all sorts of metaphors about this in our own lives, you know, whether it's, you know, you make a piece of art or you write something down and it, of course, reflects you as the author of it. Or you raise children and you know that your fingerprints are on those children. Like how they turn out is in part because of who you are and how you raise them. So this is basically on a broader scale what theologians talk about when they talk about natural theology. I want to talk a second here about this text because I think this has something actually in a way that we can weave these two things together, revealed theology and natural theology. It comes from the fifth chapter of the Gospel of John. And just a primer, just because I don't know this congregation, maybe you know all this stuff. But the Gospel of John is distinct from the other three Gospels. We call the first three Gospels the Synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And they were written probably middle of the first century, okay? The Gospel of John is written significantly later, maybe between 90 and 110. So quite a bit later. And as a result, the Gospel of John has a very different kind of voice and tenor than the first three Gospels. It has what most theologians agree is a more advanced, more developed theology because it's later and the church has been around more and Jesus has been gone longer by the time it's written down. So the people who are putting these stories together have had more time to reflect on the life of Jesus and what it meant, and they're putting the pieces together. Plus, there have been some big major changes in the world, like for instance, the temple being destroyed by the Roman generals in the year 70. So the temple in Jerusalem no longer exists, and Judaism has dramatically changed from the time that the Synoptic Gospels were written to the time the Gospel of John was written. As a result, we see different ways that the writer of the Gospel of John uses things like, for instance, miracles. Miracles are really different between the Synoptic Gospels and the Gospel of John. In the Synoptic Gospels, this will sound familiar to you. There's a lot of talk about the miracles in the Synoptics showing Jesus' power. This is a lot of what it's about, okay? That you can think of this, one of the most, like, very common in the Synoptic Gospels, after Jesus performs a miracle or does a teaching, then one of the gospel writers will write, they were amazed at the power that he had. They were shocked at the power in his words, or they were amazed at the power of his miracles. We don't hear that so much in John. John's a little bit different. John's emphasis in these miracles, here's the way to think of it. When these Synoptic Gospels are being written, the general idea in the church was Jesus is going to come back soon. By the time John is written, 40 or 50 years later, a lot of Christians and the people who are writing down these stories and the people who are gathering in churches are saying, maybe Jesus has already returned in the way of the Spirit. Maybe that's the return. It's what theologians call a realized eschatology. So eschatology is the study of like how it all ends, what it all means in the end. And the realized eschatology in the Gospel of John means God is at work now in the way that Jesus promised he would come back. So the miracles in John, in the first half of John, where all the miracles are about a sign of God's kingdom, not coming, but kind of already here. That's how the stories are told. And in fact, we see that in this text. We heard it today because the word that you don't find in the Synoptic Gospels and you do find in the Gospel of John is, this is my work. Interesting word. This is the work I'm doing, and I'm doing the work of the Father in these miracles. This particular miracle I thought was interesting in introducing this season you are all in of finding God in creation. Because it's a funny one that only occurs in John. It doesn't occur in any of the other Gospels. There's a pool that archaeologists have actually found and discovered. There's some question about the actual name of the pool. You can look in the footnotes of your Bible and it'll say different ancient manuscripts have different names for this pool. But we found this pool with the five porticos in Jerusalem. And according to this story, all sorts of people are gathered. Paralyzed people are gathered. And the story in the first century was, the idea was, when the water stirs, the first person to enter the water gets healed. And the guy Jesus comes up to is an interesting miracle because Jesus comes up to this man, this unnamed man, and he'd been there, we are told, for 38 years. He'd been paralyzed for 38 years. And this is what's interesting, is that Jesus says, "Do you want to be healed?" And the guy doesn't answer. He doesn't say, "Yes, I want to be healed." He complains that all the young whippersnappers get into the water whenever it's stirred, and he can never get there because he's too old and he's too lame. And then Jesus goes ahead and heals him. And then Jesus says, you may remember this from hearing the reading, later, when a couple verses later, explaining this miracle, "My Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working. This is my work. This is my work." The Jewish leaders go on, it's not really the point that we're talking about today, to be very upset about Jesus healing on the Sabbath. Jesus takes the disturbance of the water that this guy is waiting for, that he can never get to, and skips over that, and instead does something bigger and more consequential in Jewish life of the day. And he disturbs the Sabbath by healing on the Sabbath and by telling this guy in this common refrain that we hear in all the Gospels, "Take up your mat and walk," which he does, and then the guy gets in trouble, and the latter half of John 5 is Jesus in a long dialogue explaining why he is breaking the Sabbath law, why he's basically changing the rules. I want to tell you one more story about a disturbance. You can skip those hunting slides and get to that last one. In 1973, and because I want to tell you something about disturbance and what I've learned. In 1973, at some family land we own in central Minnesota that my grandparents bought in 1964, they were sitting down on a Monday night to have a little supper before they were going to drive the 2 hours back to Minneapolis after a long family weekend at the cabin. And my grandmother said, "I think I can hear the train in Crosby." Crosby's a town about 6 miles north of where our lake cabin is. And my grandpa, in his very famous words in our family, says, "That's not the Crosby train." And he looks out the front door of the cabin and sees a tornado, that tornado coming across the lake straight at them. They get up and they run into, like they're supposed to, into a garage in a windward building, and the tornado comes straight across the lake. That's actually taken by the people across the lake after it came through the lake and came up onto our land and destroyed these cabins that he had just built in the last 9 years. And the thing they were in collapsed around them. And long family story, but they go down and they get rescued and end up in the hospital and they survive, but what didn't survive was the forest. My grandpa had bought 164 acres of white pine forest, the oldest tree, biggest tree that we have in Minnesota, in the boreal forest area of Minnesota. They were all down, stacked like Lincoln logs, 8, 10, 12 feet high of huge white pines, completely knocked down. by this tornado. And he was so depressed that he almost sold the land. Thank God he didn't. The land is still in our family. And here's what's wild about that. He was so depressed because he loved the beauty of the old growth white pine forest. Loved it. And what came back after the tornado was not white pine. They don't regenerate naturally like that. What came back was the opportunist of northern forest, aspen. Aspen grew like weeds over 100 acres of that family land. And he didn't like them. He didn't like the aspen. He didn't appreciate their beauty and their value. And I think I didn't either when I was a kid. But I had another revelation similar to the one I had in the duck boat about finding peace in the midst of a storm in my life. And that was a couple years ago when I was grouse hunting with my two dogs through that aspen, which it's interesting because in some ways people refer to a white pine forest like foresters do as a dead forest because nothing grows under the white pines. It's nothing but acid from the needles. But when you try to walk through an aspen grove, you realize this place is teeming with life. It's growing like crazy and wildlife love it. So we're grouse hunting. I'm grouse hunting with my dogs and grouse are flushing and deer are running around and we've got turkeys in there and we've got all sorts of everything. Even bugs like are fully manifest in that kind of forest. And I remember stopping and thinking to myself, I thought my life was going to be very clean, that my life was going to be full of right angles, that everything was going to be orderly, just like I had been taught in my church growing up in this very kind of Reformed Presbyterian type of church environment. And my life ended up being, because of subsequent to that duck hunt and my time as a youth pastor, a divorce and custody fight and a lot of mess and chaos. And I realized, no, my life is like this aspen grove. There are no right angles. It's super messy. There's thistles and thorns and shrubs and everything growing up, but also it's like extraordinarily beautiful. And it was a real mind change for me to start to realize that God comes to me like, I will say, like this man in John 5, unbidden, unannounced. And I wasn't like the guy in John 5 who can't even answer Jesus' question, do you want to be healed? The guy, I mean, the obvious answer is yes. And instead, he just says, well, I can't, this isn't working out the way I thought it was going to work out. But in spite of his denseness, Jesus heals him. In spite of my own denseness to the realities of life, God came to me in messy places, messy times, and I was able to learn from these wild places that God works, in spite of my reluctance, in spite of my obtuseness, by teaching me in wild places that God comes in the chaos and the mess and the lack of right angles, and not the way I thought it was going to be in my life, but in a way that's so much more robust and abundant and beautiful. And for that, I'm thankful. Thank you for having me. Amen.